This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Tiziana Deering. The widespread consensus about the state's and the nation's mental health care system is it's broken.
Nearly 600 patients are in desperate need of mental health care, and they're currently waiting in limbo at Massachusetts hospitals for psychiatric beds.
That sound from WCVB just last night. Patients, their families, clinicians, they all cite a variety of reasons that have damaged mental health care, including access, understaffing, and not enough resources. Ken Duckworth, Chief Medical Officer of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is hoping to help. His new book contains the stories of dozens of patients and their loved ones and how they received care. The book offers advice not only about how to navigate the system, but how to advocate for improvements. Ken, thanks for being with us on Radio Boston.
Good morning, Deb, and thanks for having me.
Also with us is Sukhmani Ball from California, one of the patients that Ken writes about in his book titled You Are Not Alone. Sukhmani now has her master's degree in public health. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, folks, we're going to be discussing mental health care. So we just want to note that if you or a loved one might be suffering from a mental health crisis or have suicidal thoughts, you can call the Suicide and Crisis Hotline by dialing 988. So, Ken, in your book, you interviewed more than 100 people about their experiences. A lot of diverse experiences and thoughts in there. What would you say is the or a main issue that comes from your book?
One thing that I wanted to share about the book is I feel we've left first-person lived experience as an untapped source of wisdom. And we have a mental health crisis. We've had one before the pandemic. It's just made it worse. We don't have enough of a workforce. What if we learn from people who've managed their conditions and made their families work better? That's what I'm essentially hoping to do, is bring a new group of voices and experience to the table to help people sort these issues.
Well, because they know best.
If you've lived with bipolar disorder for 20 years, you've learned something. And if you've lived with schizophrenia for 15 years, you've learned something. If your family has had multiple generations of depression, you've also learned something. These are the perspectives that I was hoping to bring large in the book. People use their names, which speaks to the courage and the changing conversation around mental health. I wanted people to know that if you're experiencing something, there's someone like you in this book who's going through something similar to what you are.
Right. So let's just start sort of with a brief outline of the book. It's divided into several sections. One is identifying if there's a problem and what that problem might be. Now, we know every person's different, every issue's different, complicated by a lot of different factors as well. So what is there a key piece of advice that you give to someone to say, you know, how to take that first step to even be able to articulate whether there's a problem?
Well, if you have a primary care doctor, they're a great source of support. They're overworked, but are, you know, part of the backbone of the American mental health system. They deal with mental health, anxiety, and depression all the time. There's also a series of screening tools on the Mental Health America website. They're the same screening tools that you would get in a primary care office. The bottom line is functional limitations. If you're not able to participate in work or your life, and you have mood or thought difficulties, that's when I start to wonder. Those diagnostic tests, you know, the screening tests are not diagnostic per se, but they give you an indication, like taking your blood pressure at CVS. It's not the exact blood pressure, but it might let you know, hey, maybe I should attend to this.
Right, that's good. You know, Sukhmani, we mentioned you're with us as well, and you're one of the real people's voices that Ken talked about in his book. I wonder, how did you first realize you were struggling, and what did you do?
Well, I was 11 years old, and I was in the library, and I just happened across this book on depression, and I'm going through the symptom checklist, kind of like Ken said, checking my blood pressure, and I'm realizing something is very wrong. Like, I shouldn't be feeling this way, and at 11 years old, you don't really have the words to articulate that something is wrong, and I did have conversations with my PCP after that, who then talked to my parents about it and said, hey, maybe this is major depression, and, you know, we would learn 10 years later that that was a misdiagnosis, that it was actually bipolar 1, but it was really finding and having access to that first book and just being exposed to, like, what is the symptomology?
How'd your parents take it?
I think they had a hard time. No one wants there to be something wrong with their kid, let alone a mental illness. And so there was a lot of resistance to treatment. And I actually didn't get meaningful treatment until I was 5150, which is an involuntary psychiatric hold in California. And it was when my parents started talking to an Indian doctor that there was really traction around my treatment. I'm Indian, and I think talking to someone from the same cultural background was very reassuring for my parents, because they felt like, okay, this is something that not just white people go through. Like, this is something that affects our community as well.
And that's what they, that was sort of pervasive in their beliefs before.
It was. I think they felt like mental illnesses were a very, like, Western thing, and we weren't part of that mainstream culture at the time. Both my parents are from India. They're both immigrants. And mental health just wasn't part of their vernacular growing up.
Right. And so, but eventually they came around. What was it? Was it having culturally appropriate treatment, culturally sensitive treatment?
I really think it was, and especially in those, like, first formative years. And I'm still friends with that doctor. Like, It's been like, oh gosh, almost 20 years, and we're still close. So I think it says a lot about the love that he put into his practice, which is also important, because I think if you don't love and care for your patients, then you're not necessarily doing them the best service.
Right. Ken, what do you think? What did you learn about diversity in the mental health workforce? Where does it stand right now?
One of the people who helped me with the book is my academic chair at Harvard, Maturi Keshavan. He trained in India, Vienna, London, Detroit, and Boston, and felt that the United States has the most fragmented mental health system of any he had observed, which was a worldwide perspective that really helped me to see what people are going through is not about you. This system is a collection of services that is disjointed and underfunded. What I learned is that persistence along the journey, that you might not find the right caregiver who understands you or your culture right away. But if you stay with it, if you find your local NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness chapter, if you talk to peers, people who've been there, if you participate in this, the system's unlikely to get better quickly. So don't wait for it to get better. Mm. Keep going is what I've learned. And people did find help. It just took them longer than they wanted.
Yeah, and easy to get discouraged.
It's very easy to get discouraged. And you may have to do advocacy. There's a chapter on how people advocated for themselves, how people had to talk to their doctors about side effects, how to battle their health insurance plan to get payment covered. Unfortunately, there is an obstacle course that people contend with in the mental health space. And you need perseverance and support to engage in that kind of advocacy.
Sugmani, you mentioned misdiagnosing, right?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, Ken, what about that kind of a problem? Like, that makes it even harder when we can't really even get a handle on what's happening with people.
Because the mental health field lacks biological markers, like blood pressure. Let's just stay with our little metaphor for this morning's conversation. You know, we rely on symptoms. So doctors or clinicians, social workers see you in snapshot. But a diagnosis is actually the movie of a person's life, and it's easy to get it wrong in one snapshot. I have a whole chapter where people discuss how their diagnoses were wrong initially or misplaced, and how losing years of connecting to the right treatment was also a problem. But I think you'll find the people who are in that chapter are extremely gracious. Like, they found help. And they wanted to tell their story about being misdiagnosed in order to reduce the amount of time that others have to live with that kind of challenge.
Right. Sukhmani, what would you say from that time at 11 when you were reading that book until you got the right type of care? How long did you have to hang in there?
10 years, which is actually pretty average for bipolar diagnoses. So it was really after there was a shooting at my college, and the stress of the shooting caused me to have my first big manic episode. And that was kind of the flag to my psychiatrist at that time that, hey, this isn't depression, this is bipolar disorder. And it was really then that I got on the right combination of medications and started treatment and started feeling better. And I didn't even know that I could feel as good as I felt. It was just, it was really amazing.
Yeah. You know, I hear about that a lot. I do quite a few stories about mental health, and I hear from a lot of people about that folks who have a mental health issue may not recognize it, may not recognize how good they can feel when they're well. And so that is another complicating factor. How prevalent is it for someone not to admit or acknowledge their mental health problem, and what do you do about that?
Well, Deb, it's a complicated question. I'm going to give you mind and brain answers. The mind answer is I don't want to have something. Mm. Society wouldn't encourage me to have something, right? It's a socially not a good thing to have. That's closer to denial. And the strategy for that, if you have somebody in your life with that, is motivational interviewing. I asked the man who invented motivational interviewing to frame how you might discuss it. For people who have an illness which can involve psychosis, which is connections to realities that others don't perceive, they literally can't see what is wrong with them. This is the medical term for that, is anosognosia. And I experienced this in my own dad, you know, who would communicate with the microwave oven when manic and psychotic. And then 6 months later, after treatment, he would use it to heat up his coffee. And I thought, this is brain. This isn't mind, mm-hmm. right? He's not in denial. Now, after he got back from the hospital, we would both happily participate in denial because I just wanted a loving dad again. So we didn't really develop these conversations. So it's a complicated and difficult thing to contend with. And this is very frustrating for families. But like with Alzheimer's disease or strokes, there are brain-related phenomena that prevent some people from appreciating that they are ill. They are not in denial. They're not doing this to you. They literally can't see it. And I think it's really important to have that in mind. Javier Amador, who developed a whole strategy of how to communicate lovingly and compassionately with people, is also a person I interviewed for the book.
Mm-hmm. And so is it, would you say, a majority of people who may really not understand the reality of their mental health?
I'm not sure you could say a majority. There's a substantial subset of people that can't appreciate that they're ill, and there's another substantial subset of people who can't acknowledge the possibility, even if they know they're struggling. Because of how our society has made mental health conditions such a low social status thing to have. Mm. So I think it's a complicated answer to a hard question.
Yeah. I want to talk about, sort of in line with that, assisted outpatient treatment, or AOT.
Yes.
Controversial here in Massachusetts.
Yes.
Massachusetts is one of three states that does not allow for someone to be committed to outpatient treatment, essentially forced to do it. There's just debate on this last year. Mm-hmm. So in your book, you say it can be helpful and life-saving.
For a small number of people. So I interviewed a man named Eric Smith in Texas, who was basically unable to see that he was ill. He's now a star social work student at the University of San Antonio in Texas. And what he said is the most coercive experience of his life was not AOT, which was a judge-ordered intervention for him with a team that kept him accountable. The most coercive thing he experienced was a profound untreated psychosis. And that was his experience. And again, I think the beauty of the book is you can learn from people. You know, this is not a policy piece. This was his actual experience. A real person uses his name. I'm sure you can contact Eric Smith in San Antonio, Texas. He loves to talk about this because he isn't into invalidating people's concerns about coercion. He just said, this is what helped me.
Right.
Right? And that was the beauty of the book, is a lot of different people developed a lot of different things that helped them, whether it's faith, a culturally sensitive clinician, peers, giving to others, figuring out how to engage with their families in new ways. So the beauty of the book, in my opinion, is so many people found different ways. That gives me hope, you know, that you can find a way, even if it looks difficult and the system is a mess.
Do you think then assisted outpatient treatment is a good thing? We should, from a policy perspective.
For a small percentage of people, I think it's a helpful thing. And that's the National Alliance on Mental Illness says basically every other tool should be used first. And so AOT should not be a substitute for an underfunded system where people are on wait lists for 6 months. That's not really a good use of, you know, AOT. The system should be welcoming and funded. People should not have a long wait list. So this kind of begs the question, right? Where does AOT fit into the portfolio? if you can't get an appointment, right, it kind of, you know, begs the question in a way.
Right. I want to talk about, you know, we're running out of time, and this is unfortunately, but I also, you know, a big issue is mental illness compounded by substance use disorder, right?
Yes.
A dual diagnosis, as it's called, when there's addiction and mental health issues. And, you know, we've heard for many years that the system to treat both is very fragmented. It's one or the other. It's the mental health or the addiction. Is it getting better?
We're doing a good job of trying to pull these cultures together. But remember, the history of AA is specifically non-professionally driven. You are the agent of your addiction. You need to find help. And in the mental health field, we're much more accepting. Okay, this has a brain component to it. We're going to do things for you. Integrating those cultures has been a very important thing. And I think we've done a pretty good job in Massachusetts of providing screening for mental health in the addiction space and also acknowledging that there are medical treatments that can be useful in addiction care. So we're making some progress, but these are two cultures that are historically quite distinct.
And just briefly, because we've got only about 2 minutes left here, we are making progress. We are, despite the broken, despite the lack of funding, despite insurance issues and all of those things that can go along with this, you would say the system is getting better?
We're incrementally making a dent. A lot of people in the book are fighting for better services and better care. And the fact that 130 people were willing to share their experience, use their names, is to me another commentary on how far we're coming as a society. Mental health is health. It shouldn't be in a socially isolated, shame-prone corner. Brain is part of the body.
I want to give Sukumani the last word here. Get your voice in here, as Ken has been advocating. What advice do you give to folks who may be struggling and to families who may be trying to figure this out?
That's always such a tough question because there's so much to say. I would always say that there's like three tiers to recovery. The first is the introduction of medication to bring a person to a place where they can interact with the second tier, which is therapy to make sense of the new world that they're living in. And the third is love. And I think love is the most important component of this because without love, you don't really have much to live for. So sustaining that love for your loved one, even when it's tough, and letting them know that you're there is really the biggest thing that you can do for someone. And it's not a huge heroic task. It's just a text letting them know that, you know, you're there. I think it's really just the support of people around you that's important.
That's a beautiful way to end. Mm. Yeah. Sukumani Ball is featured in the new book titled You Are Not Alone. She recently obtained her Master of Public Health. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
The author of the book is Ken Duckworth, Chief Medical Officer of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Deb.
And again, listeners, if you or a loved one might be suffering a mental health crisis or having suicidal thoughts, you can call this Suicide and Crisis Hotline by dialing 988. Just this week, hearing aids became available without a prescription at pharmacies and retail stores, and that's big news for the estimated 37 million adults in the U.S. who have trouble hearing. Massachusetts U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren was a champion of this. This is what she said in 2017 when she was asked about the bill she co-sponsored to allow hearing aids to be provided over the counter.
If hearing loss seems like a boring problem, I want you to think about what it means to be unable to participate in a meaningful conversation with another person, unable to talk on the telephone or to hear a television or radio.
We're going to dive into this topic on this week's Tech Talk with Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, good to see you. So does this mean that hearing aids can be purchased like reading glasses at your local pharmacy?
Not quite. I mean, you can. It's just that they're still going to be really expensive, but not nearly as expensive as they used to be. A typical modern, well-made hearing aid might have cost you $5,000 or even more. Because of the nature of how hearing aids work, now you'll be able to go to a store and get them for prices probably no more than $1,000, and often in some cases significantly lower, like $700 or $800, depending on which ones you buy. And this is a whole new thing that was made possible by this legislation that was signed by the Trump administration, that was pushed by Elizabeth Warren back in 2017. But it took 5 years for the Food and Drug Administration to complete the preparing the regulations under which to allow this, because they had to set standards for what are called self-fitting. That's what it's called, self-fitting hearing aids. Mm. And that's what are now available. These are called self-fitting hearing aids, and they don't just mean that you can physically adjust them to fit your ears. Because it turns out, this is something I didn't know anything about because I'd never had hearing problems. It turns out that what you are getting when you go to an audiologist or a doctor who's going to fit you for hearing aids is this very sophisticated process of figuring out exactly what kind of hearing loss you have. Mm-hmm. Because hearing loss doesn't just mean everything is quiet. You can't quite make things out anymore. Usually it means that some kind of damage has happened that has caused particular aspects of your hearing to become more problematic. You can't hear like lower frequencies as well, or you can't hear higher frequencies as well. And the doctor has to give you these tests to figure out exactly which aspects you're having trouble hearing. And then they take the hearing aid and they tune it so that it will give you a boost in just the areas that you need.
Okay, so in that case, mm-hmm. I can almost say, well, of course it's going to cost a couple thousand. It's going to be expensive to have some medical device specifically tailored for you.
Exactly.
Right? So if it's not as expensive, is it not as good?
Well, no, that's the thing. Welcome to the 21st century, because now what you have are hearing aids that have Bluetooth chips inside so they can talk to your smartphone and they can be reprogrammed. And that means the owner themselves can now do it. You can put software on the phone and tune the hearing aid yourself. That's why they're called self-fitting. You actually sit there and figure out exactly what settings on the hearing aid are going to give you the optimum result. You have an app for doing this. Like, for example, there's a company, a South African company called Lexi, and they are working in cooperation with Bose. Everybody knows Bose. They're based here in Framingham. Bose was in the hearing aid business, decided to get out of it, but they took their intellectual property and they did a deal to work with Lexi on this. Bose has the technology inside the hearing aid and on an app that lets you adjust the hearing aid for your particular needs. And all these other companies are doing the same thing. So you don't need a doctor to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. That's what makes this practical.
And that's what makes it less expensive.
Absolutely, if you can do it yourself.
Okay, but let's just say I have, first of all, it puts a lot on a consumer, to be able to figure this out. And in my head, even though this may be stereotypical, I see my 80-plus-year-old in-laws trying to navigate an app to make sure that their hearing aid is working appropriately.
That is an absolutely legitimate concern. Some people are going to need help to do it even with this. But you could still get friends to do it. You can still get family members to do it. And basically, what you're able to get them to do is say, all right, tell me if this sounds better or worse. Better or like when you go to the eye doctor. Better or worse. Better or worse. And you can do that and figure it out. Everybody agrees, and this is true of traditional hearing aids too, that it often takes multiple sessions. And you can spend weeks trying to figure out what's the best setting for your hearing. And not only that, I was talking to this guy, Dr. Lin. He's at, I think, Johns Hopkins. And he was talking about how the parts of your brain that hear particular frequencies will sort of get out of practice if you haven't been able to hear them for a while. And so you may have to spend weeks listening to the new hearing aid before you begin to actually hear the improvements that you're looking for. So it doesn't happen overnight.
So would there be a range of hearing aids? You know, when I was reading up for this, I read an incredible statistic that from the National Institute on Deafness saying 1 in 8 people in the U.S. over the age of 12 has hearing loss in both ears. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is just remarkable, and that's based on standard hearing examination. So would there have to be like this wide range of devices that consumers would then choose from?
You have to keep in mind, all of these devices that are coming over the counter are for mild to moderate hearing loss. These are not for people who have really severe hearing problems. And everybody will tell you that this is for somebody who just has a little trouble hearing, like they said, somebody who can generally hear, but who can't, for example, hear clearly when they're on a phone or can't hear clearly when they're watching television. It's not for people who have really severe problems. They still need to go to a doctor. So that's an entirely different thing. Oh, I want to mention this briefly because it hadn't come up, because I left this out of my story and it's really important. Recent research has shown that people who go for extended period of time with hearing loss and don't get it fixed actually experience cognitive decline. Your brain doesn't work as well. Huh. There is actually some evidence that there's a higher risk of dementia in people who aren't hearing clearly. And if you think about it, that makes sense. It's like you're not as engaged with the world around you and your brain just starts to slow down a little bit. So there are really important reasons for people to try to get this done. But I had this in the story. I don't remember the numbers, but an amazingly large percentage of people with hearing loss never get anything done about it. They never get hearing aids because of the expense And this is supposed to actually enable that problem to at least start going away.
Right. Would someone still have to go to a doctor, though, or could they just say, you know what, I can't hear on the phone as well anymore. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to go down to the pharmacy and pick up.
Well, yeah, in principle, you could do that. I mean, that's the whole point. You can walk right down to the store and see if you need one. I don't know. I would think it would still be a good idea to just first time out get a doctor's advice about that. But once you get confirmation that you might need aid with your hearing, yeah, the idea is that you should now be able to do this on your own.
What do you think are some precautions that people should be aware of if they're going to buy a hearing aid over the counter?
I don't know. I guess the first one is remember that you want to make sure you're actually getting a hearing aid. There are these things, what do they call them? Personal audio, there's a term.
Amplifiers?
Personal sound amplifying systems. And they're fine and dandy, but they're not hearing aids. These have already been available for many years over the counter. All they are is an amplifier. You put them on, you turn it on, and it just makes everything louder. That's not a hearing aid. A hearing aid is designed to be tailored to the specific hearing problem of the person using it. And you have to make sure that what you're getting is actually a hearing aid. By the way, I've heard one of these companies, I think it's Jabra, still is not calling their product a hearing aid because they're being hyper-cautious. They don't want to step over any regulatory lines. But yes, you definitely want to confirm that these products you're looking at are getting FDA approval as for sale as over-the-counter hearing aids. And you can definitely confirm with the FDA whether or not a particular product has been approved. And I know that this company, Lexi, has approved products. Sony is coming to market with approved products. Jabra, even though they are calling them hearing aids, they're coming to market with approved products. A bunch of other companies are going to be in there. I don't know. I hate to tell people not to go and get their hearing fixed, but as with any new consumer electronics product, I wouldn't be in any terrible rush. I'd wait a year. That's just my basic principle about these things. And let somebody else do the beta testing. And that's just the principle I live by. Never be the first one to buy a new gadget.
Okay, well, that's good advice. I just want to move on briefly to solar paneled cars.
Ah, yes, the car of the future.
Right. So you've written a lot about this, right? And recently you wrote a piece about a car powered by solar panels. Tell us a little bit about it.
Not exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, no, it's this German car from a company and startup called Sono. The car is called the Scion. It's not available in the U.S. yet. They're just touring around. They brought one to Boston. It has solar panels embedded in all the exterior surfaces of the car. And they say that you will get about 10 miles of charge per day if you use these solar panels. And it's got a battery.
10 miles. Let's just back that up right there. Not too far. That's not even close to my commute.
Yeah, exactly. The car itself only has a range of about 190 miles. But on the other hand, it's designed to sell for about $25,000. And it looks like it was designed to sell for. It's a boxy, plasticky looking vehicle. It's an economy vehicle. Nobody's ever going to mistake it for a Tesla. But their argument is that just the extra 10 miles that you will gain by leaving it parked outside will reduce the amount of time that you might have to spend by charging it up and save you hundreds of dollars a year in electricity cost. But it is no substitute for plugging the car in and charging it up. The interesting thing is there's a bunch of companies out there that are trying to do this, that are offering battery. There's one that's like a three-wheeled vehicle that is supposed to get 40 miles a day on their solar cells. But partly because the car is so small that it holds like two people or something, and it's like a little runabout. So, yeah, I'm thinking solar power is not going to be a practical way to substitute for plugging in the car, but it might provide you with a little extra range by supplementing the electrical charge, and it could let you run your systems like your air conditioning or your heating or something like that.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. You know, are these cars in use overseas right now? Not at all?
No, they are. The company has got pre-orders for 20,000 of them. Huh. Well, actually, 20,000 consumer, 22,000 commercial, because there are companies that want to add them to their commercial fleets. They've lined up a manufacturer in Finland to make them. They're this Finnish company that makes Mercedes-Benzes, and they're going to make them as well. One of the things I've learned doing this is a lot of cars are made by companies you never heard of, and they make them for the big companies. This company in Finland makes Mercedes-Benzes. Who knew?
Could it be that the technology will improve, like the hearing aids?
Absolutely.
Maybe not these first ones. Maybe they may not be the best, but eventually.
But there are limits. I mean, you have to have a certain amount of surface area, And in addition, it's a car. It's moving all the time. Its relative position, you know, relative to the sun is going to be constantly moving. There are going to be cloudy days. There's nighttime. What do you park the car? They always say, well, you can charge your car up at night. Not this one, you can't. No, sir. It's not going to work that well. But that doesn't mean it's useless. By the way, this company has another thing they're doing, which might make a lot more sense. They sell a product that you put on the tops of buses, and they're selling these to city bus companies. You put the solar cells on the buses, and all it does is provide battery power for the air conditioning, and it saves fuel. That might work, because a bus has a big surface area. That might actually work.
Okay.
But the cars, I don't know.
All right. We've been talking with Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray. Hiawatha, thanks for joining us for another edition of Tech Talk.
Thanks a lot.
We're just a few weeks away from Halloween, so for the rest of the show, we'll be revisiting a few conversations to help you get into the spirit. Double feature, if you will. We're going to start with a story that's pretty well known in Massachusetts, the Salem Witch Trials. A part of the story that's less well known, though, are accounts of networks of people who secretly helped accused witches escape to safety. Some Massachusetts historians say there's evidence that in 1693, some of those suspected of witchcraft made their way to what is now the Framingham-Ashland area to hide in what are still called the Witch Caves. Back in 2018, I visited the caves.
I'm Rob St. Germain, and I'm a member of the Ashland Town Forest Committee.
Rob St. Germain often takes visitors into the woods in Ashland just off the road named Salem End Road. Local lore suggests that it was here where Sarah Bridges Clays, sometimes recorded as Clay or Cloys, fled once she escaped from jail where she was awaiting sentencing on witchcraft charges. St. Germain cites local historians who say Clay's husband broke her out of jail and they likely had others help them secretly travel to these woods to hide in its tall, rocky spots.
We are headed toward a cliff, and this was the supposed home for a period of time of Sarah Nurse Clay, and Sarah Clay was sprung out of jail. She was condemned, and her husband sprung her out of jail.
Because she was accused of being a witch.
She was accused of being a witch. Suddenly there were some accusations, and all it took back in those days was to point a finger and you were guilty. Even more so then than today, women were looked down upon, women were suspect, women were feared. And the juries and prosecutors, of course, were all men. And so we have Me Too way back then, or the need for Me Too way back then, but it didn't happen. Her two sisters had already been executed, and her husband took matters into his own hands, and he sprung her out of jail. They probably had a network. There is some historical references to a possible underground network or railroad, because others escaped by it as well.
Ultimately, like an underground railroad for people accused of witchcraft.
Escaped the false accusations of witchcraft, yes.
It was such a volatile time, St. Germain says, that the Clays probably were in hiding for quite a while.
So here we are at the foot of this rock outcropping, and it's a bunch of tumbled down boulders. It's a beautiful location, and if you look up into these rocks, there are some small caves, some places that you can crawl into. And if the husband was indeed a woodsman, a frontiersman, as history suggests, he would have known how to block up some of the holes and create shelters in these boulders. At the time, this was a pretty wild place. There were certainly an abundance of deer and probably wolves still back then and a lot of smaller game. And so there was plenty here for them to hunt. And so they spent at least a winter here. Some recounts of the story say they spent about 2 years here.
In the cave?
In the caves, yeah. Yeah, letting the whole situation cool off. Letting the political process in Boston catch up with the bad situation in Salem and put an end to it.
Now, how do we know for sure that this sort of rock-strewn area
was really the site where she may have hid, maybe others hid, to try to escape some of that hysteria.
This is supposedly either through, verbal records or maybe some historical records, or maybe just myth, was the place where they ultimately settled. And, of course, the history also recounts that once they left the caves, they started building houses, and the houses are not far from here.
The records of those houses provide what's probably the strongest evidence that this is more than local lore. And those records help answer the question, why these rocks in these woods? St. Germain says that's because those fleeing Salem were likely looking for the property owned by former Deputy Governor Thomas Danforth, who had been a judge in, you guessed it, Salem. Not only a judge, but a member of the Salem Witch Tribunals.
They came to this place, which was called Danforth Plantation or Danforth Farms at the time. And the Danforths were friendly, were sympathizers. They were rational people. They were educated people.
Because Danforth had been a judge.
Yes.
And he may have felt some personal responsibility.
Yes.
Correct? So
yes.
Then became sort of a stop for folks because he was sympathetic to those who were accused.
Exactly. And ultimately, the history book shows that he gave 800 acres of land. He had been given 16,000 acres of land in this area by a grant, but he gave 800 acres to the people who had been accused.
The Clay's house is still standing, officially now in Framingham. It's one of five so-called witch houses in this area. And property records provide another clue that this region was likely considered a safe haven for those accused of witchcraft. In 1700, in the township petition for Framingham, at least 50 people related to Sarah Clay's and her sisters had resettled to this area. St. Germain points out this would have been incredibly difficult at a time when there were no roads, certainly no GPS devices. But St. Germain says local lore has it that there was a low-tech way for the witch trial escapees to find this refuge. He says they knew they were safe when they got to an enormous boulder about the size of a cottage, which, by the way, is still here, across from the Clay's house on Salem End Road. Although now it's surrounded by professional landscaping in a private front yard.
Whether they knew in advance how to get here, whether the boulder was indeed, as the myth says, a form of guidance or identification that they had arrived, it's hard to know. Much of history is not exact, as we know.
But it's interesting that it's really part of the town's history, right?
It is.
Witchcraft is really a part. Everyone thinks of Salem, but I think there's...
Yeah, it's part of the state's history and it's part of the nation's history. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know what the origin are, but one could certainly speculate that this type of activity where these women were unfairly, unjustly killed led ultimately to the good of innocent until proven guilty.
That was a conversation from 2018 with Rob St. Germain, a member of the Ashland Town Forest Committee, about Ashland's so-called witch caves. The film Get Out from Jordan Peele in 2017 was a genre-defining moment for horror movies. In it, Chris, a young black man, visits his girlfriend's family, and he becomes increasingly uncomfortable around the all-white family and has some eerie moments, like this one with their black staff.
I can assure you, I don't answer to anyone.
Right. All I know is sometimes, but... there's too many white people, I get nervous, you know.
Black actors have always had roles in horror films, but the success of Get Out ushered in a new era of black horror that's continued. In 2020, we had a conversation with independent academic Kiara Sterling about this. At the time, she was teaching a class on black horror at the Coolidge Corner Theater. In this revisited conversation, Tiziana Deering started by asking Kiara why the movie Get Out was so important.
Get Out really was able to articulate a black experience and a black contemporary experience in a way that we haven't really seen before. So the way that Get Out centralizes the sort of paranoia that a lot of black folks are led to be shamed for having, the way that Get Out uses the microaggression as a way to understand that the horror in this contemporary society is perhaps the white liberal, right, that would have voted for Obama for a third term. I think that Get Out, you know, was able to really just kind of visualize this idea of the sunken place as this literal sort of embodiment of that paralysis of fear and confusion that a lot of Black folks were feeling in the post-racial Obama phase.
So that was a movie of that moment. Let's now back up for a second. We'll come back to that. But I want you to walk us through the difference between a Black character in a horror movie, which we've seen for years and years, and actual Black mm-hmm. horror as a genre.
Yeah, so I think this is the slippage of talking about Black horror, right? You know, Black folks have been represented on screen since the 1800s. And if we are really to think about that, we're thinking about how they're represented. That gives a different orientation of what horror is, especially for Black folks that have been depicted as evil and as this sort of embodiment of monstrosity since the inception of Black folks on screen. So there is a reason for us to think about D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation as the first Black horror film, which effectively is depicting, you know, this Black man as this evil that must be overcome. And whether we trace that on into Black horror as a sort of sci-fi and the creature feature of whether it be King Kong or whether it be Creature from the Black Lagoon, these films that are depicting or associating the monstrous other with this sort of foreign evil that's very different from the sort of white normative individual that we take to be the status quo.
So the first real heyday of Black horror films was in the 60s and 70s. And one of the seminal films from that period was Blackula from 1972. I want to play a clip. This is Mumawalde, or Blackula, played by William Marshall, speaking with Dr. Gordon Thompson of the Los Angeles Police, and he's played by Thalmas Rasulallah. Here we go.
The police have a theory about these killings.
Are we to assume that they believe a vampire or some other such creature is responsible?
A vampire?
Yes, it may be.
However, many in the department don't believe it.
Now, I would think that to be the vampire's greatest defense.
You're right.
So there's Mumawalde just running the table on that conversation. Tell us about Blackula and why it was such a big moment for Black filmmaking.
Blackula is so exciting. So the 1970s are a really important part of an heyday, as you said, of Black filmmaking period, because it's the first time in a long time that you really get Black folks that have access to big studio money. And so when Blackula comes on the scene, it really kind of shifts the balance of the horror genre because it's able to, for the first time, really intervene in this idea of who the monster is and shift that paradigm by showing Blackula, who is himself a monster, right? He's a vampire that's kind of wreaking havoc on 1970s LA. But you also understand Blackula to have been created by Count Dracula. And so in doing so, it is giving us a larger context about the white vampire as a sort of metaphor for the way that whiteness and white imperialism continues to have a vampiric effect on Blackness and the Black community.
So let's fast forward now, because based on what you just said, it's the perfect time to bring in Lovecraft Country. It takes place in the 1950s Jim Crow America, and it follows a Black man mm-hmm. named Atticus, played by Jonathan Majors, as he road trips to a town in Massachusetts where the horror writer H.P. Lovecraft supposedly based many of his fictional stories. And there are two tiers of horror at play here, with many arguing that the most disturbing tier is the violent racism that the characters encounter. Here's a bit of the first episode. Atticus, his friend, and his uncle are pulled over by a racist sheriff in Devon County. The sheriff's name is Eustace Hunt, and here's what he tells them.
Any of you all know what a sundown town is?
Yes, sir, we do.
Well, this is a sundown county. If I had found you in my woods like animals after dark, it would have been my sworn duty to hang every single one of you from them trees.
It's not sundown yet.
You are a big fan of the show. Can you situate it for us in the lineage of the Black horror genre?
Yeah, Lovecraft Country is responding so directly to so many of the films that we've seen throughout the balance of Black horror. And as you noted, it's really trying to get into, much like what Peele did in Get Out, the sort of more insidious effects of the white imagination. I think that a great way and sort of a great embodiment, especially as the series unfolds, to think about that is through Christina's character and her relationship with pretty much most of the other central characters mm-hmm. in the film. You know, I think that Christina is a great sort of embodiment of our contemporary white feminism and the way that she's sort of, you know, unabashedly destructive, and the ways that blackness still kind of operates around her as a character for a need of survival that's often kind of chided or subverted at different points. But it really gives us a really good contemplation about how black folks are interacting with history and how the legacy of blackness has invariably been connected to a relationship to the horrifying.
You know, I have always hated most horror because I don't get the moment after the scare where I realize I'm safe and I can breathe a sigh of relief. It just makes me think someone would do that to me if they could. Now, I'm white, mm-hmm. but in preparing for the segment, I read scholars referring to a kind of catharsis that black horror can sometimes offer by depicting mm-hmm. racial trauma and the realities of racism as being on the level of horror. But I also wonder, does that have a toll of its own sometimes?
I think that, you know, I always bring up the way that black folks bring to whatever they're viewing, whether it's for, you know, a major commercial film that they're seeking kind of a catharsis from, or a art house horror, an oppositional gaze. And this is something that bell hooks talks about. It's the way that black folks, particularly black women, are so used to seeing themselves represented on film in a way that's inaccurate, that they develop and cultivate a sort of spectorial skepticism. And that allows them to kind of critically engage, whether they realize it or not, with the way that they're being represented. And I think that that's really key to this idea of catharsis. And I think that this is what's also a very important aspect of black horror, is that you're able to finally, whether you're a white spectator or a black spectator, you're able to be resituated when you see a black cast negotiating black horrors, and you're forced to contend with how you may or may not sympathize with the white character, and how the sort of white character is perhaps embodying that sort of white imagination, or understand how a black character is understanding and sort of responding to that effect or consequence of the white imagination in real time.
That was independent academic Kiera Sterling talking about the new era of black horror with host Tiziana Deering. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Tiziana Deering returns tomorrow for more Radio Boston.